Please note that this message should only be heard after first listening to the previous parts of this sermon series titled This Generation, Parts 1 and 2. These serve as a critical introduction.
All right, we're on what amounts to Part 3 on Sabbath 2. And I want to start with a verse, finish the last thought really before we broke away. But we'll open with it here by turning to Revelation chapter 14. I don't know if I have ever read this verse even one time in a sermon in my ministry. If I have, I have no recollection of it, and I frankly doubt it. I've covered it in Bible studies, but it's interesting that if you pick up in Revelation 14, after it talks about the 144,000 before Mount Zion, you come to what are called the three angels' messages. The Sardis church got confused and thought the gospel had to do with the three angels' messages. But let me just pick up here. One of these obscure verses that most never think about, but it shows you the importance of the work of God. And I saw another angel, verse 6, Revelation 14 and verse 6. And I saw another angel fly in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach unto them that dwell on the earth, and to every nation and kindred and tongue and people. There's an angel. How important is the work of God? In other words, you have the two witnesses following the work, which is done twice, first in the 20th century, then in the 21st. And then, in effect, phase four, the last opportunity across the world for people to wake up, is it says this angel comes and says, "Fear God." An angel thunders to the whole world, "Fear God and give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of waters." They don't often think of that. There followed another angel saying, "Babylon has fallen, that great city, because she made all nations drink of the wine of the wrath of her fornication." And the third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, a warning, listen, an angel is thundering this. "If any man worship the beast in his image and receive his mark in his forehead or in his hand, the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of the indignation." Powerful warnings. Now, at the end of the age, and I've tried to make this clear, a fair, just, and loving God warns. No parent would punish his own child or children without telling them why he's going to punish them. A world punishment is for a reason. It's not just the angry blast of a God who is suddenly run amok, out of control. Far from it. It has nothing to do with that. Punishment is for a reason. Whether it's the horseman riding, whether it's the great tribulation, whether it's the day of the Lord or the very capstone of the day of the Lord, which is Armageddon, when 200 million people in what I call the fourth wave of punishment are destroyed, literally they dissolve right on their feet outside Jerusalem in the Valley of Jehoshaphat. That's really kind of an unbelievable series of things that God is going to do. Never in history, just unbelievable. Now, you know, you use the term unbelievable, and unfortunately when you have to use it, and it really means just unbelievable in the human sense, you've used the word and it's a cliche, it's hackneyed. But what's going to happen is truly unbelievable to those who are outside God's church, who know when God says something, it will happen, it is believable, it's going to take place. But God would never do all of that without the most profound warning that has ever been uttered. Before God was going to destroy Nineveh, he sent his prophet. His prophet Jonah was reluctant. Before God executed individual kings, he sent prophets to them. Noah preached, and his great-grandfather Enoch preached for 300 years prior to the flood. The Lord comes with 10,000s of his saints. God warns. Over and over, God warns. Prophets went into the house of Judah and the house of Israel, and warned both of them that they would go into captivity. Through Moses, God said in Leviticus 26, 46 verses in 26, 68 verses in Deuteronomy 28. Now, that's 114 verses of blessings and cursings, obedience and disobedience or consequences either way. God long ago said to Israel what would be at stake if she pursued other gods and didn't follow him. God warns. I mean, right down to at the very end, it's going to have angels thundering. And people, for the most part, of course, will not and have never heeded in any significant numbers. Nineveh was kind of an anomaly in world history. Most others simply don't heed. But it won't be because God didn't try. A fair, just, and loving God, and patient God, will give every opportunity. Now, I want to change gears and start going into some very different things. We're going to look at some more things in the Bible, but I'm going to set up a most important message. In many regards, for the world as a whole and for the church, the most important part of the message, beginning last week after the sermonette, starts in effect now. And you'll just have to hear what I'm going to say. Bear in mind, one of the themes of what I'm trying to do is to break and even shatter into dust the whole idea that you can have life as other generations had it, or the millennium residents, if you will, the world will have it. I've got to break from your mind, and I've had to break it from my own mind, that we're nearing the end of all things. All the models, all the patterns of life simply no longer are going to hold. Everything is going to change. You have to be willing to give things up. Now, 30 years ago, in January 1980, Mr. Armstrong wrote what is a famous article, unfortunately not followed very much, and it was entitled, "Prepare to Greatly Reduce Your Standard of Living." How many of you old-timers remember it? Okay, a few hands go up. It was produced in January 1980 for the first time. May of 83, it was reproduced while Mr. Armstrong was still alive, and then a little over a year, April of 87, it was produced again by his successor, or someone made the decision to have it go back into print. It's a long article. I'm going to read really very little of it, but I want to read it to you. And before I do, I want you to understand that most people blew it off. Now, there may have been some few, I never met one of them, who heard it almost 31 years ago and held the course. I never heard of one. There were some, I think, that heard it and tried for a while. I know some of them. And there were some who heard it and never gave it another thought, even though it appeared three times and was preached on periodically by others besides its author, Mr. Armstrong. Again, the power of people to delude themselves when now they've had 31 years nearly, 31 years since we were told to begin to do something. Most said, "My Lord delays his coming." And they ate and drank with the drunken. They surfeited. They were choked by the cares of the world. And tens of thousands of people paid a terrible price for having ignored the message in this powerful article. If you can get it. Read the whole thing. It's too long for me to say more. I'm going to read simply the first few paragraphs that introduce it and the very tail end of it and describe in a couple sentences what's in between. Mr. Armstrong opens, "It's time you knew the real meaning of the present inflationary spiral." Now, as you hear him talk a little bit about the economy, ask, what would he say today in the second month of the third year of the worst economic downturn we've seen since the Great Depression? What would he say if he wrote it today? "The real meaning of the present inflationary spiral, rising interest rates and fears of entering a severe depression." Sound familiar? "There is far more to all this economic concern than appears on the surface. Its roots even penetrate back into ancient history and biblical prophecy." Mr. Armstrong always tied things back. I try to do the same. "Where are the United States and British nations mentioned in Bible prophecy?" Now, mind you, he wrote this 60 days, about 2 months, before he released the final version of his book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. So this was in the Plain Truth magazine. I think it actually appeared in April 87 in the Good News and then reappeared in May 83 in the Plain Truth. Because there's a message for everybody, world, if they're willing to listen, and of course the church. "What is prophesied about these very conditions?" He's setting the stage for the release of his book. "What does it all really mean? What does it portend for the relatively immediate future? We in the United States have enjoyed the most prosperous living standard of any nation in all the history of mankind. There is a reason for this unmatched prosperity that came to us. There also is a reason for the devaluation of the dollar in foreign markets, for our present abnormal inflation, and the fear in financial and government circles that we may well be in the beginning of the most severe economic depression in history." Because God wanted a second work to prophesy again, Mr. Armstrong, as I've said many times, did not understand timing, but he was dead on in terms of what he was saying. A number of times I published an economic analysis of the real causes of the inflation spiral and other economic distresses in the United States. But now the stranglehold of inflation and other economic disturbances are tightening around our necks. This trend is going to reach out and greatly reduce your standard of living in the next two or more years. Well, it actually got pretty bad for a while. Jimmy Carter was president, and it actually was a true statement. He didn't say the end would come, but he was dead right. I bought a house, 16 and an eighth interest rate. Don't try it. Okay? It's a different story, but I'm trying to illustrate a point. He was dead on. Actually, what has happened to us now is much more than purely economic causes and effects. Yet, of course, these have contributed their part. I've written more than once about an incident in my personal experience which took place in early January 1914. This was before most of our readers were born, but I was covering a significant event. I was then an editorial representative of America's largest trade journal. I was traveling by train, of course, in those days, eastward in New York State from Buffalo. At Utica, I received a telegram from our editors instructing me to catch the first train back to Detroit to interview Henry Ford. Henry Ford was on banner front page headlines in that morning's newspaper. The Ford Motor Company had just come out with a sensational new $5 a day wage scale, highest in the world or ever. Don't laugh. $5 was a lot of money in 1914. My editors wanted me to cover this story and get all the facts in person. In a sense, that was the beginning of the highest living standard ever enjoyed in any nation, although the American standard was already perhaps the world's highest, I think about $3.75 per day for a 10-hour day, by the way, 10 hours back then. Now it's 8 with breaks and other things and lots of holidays. But with Henry Ford's sensational new wage scale, our living standard was to escalate to an all-time world peak. So he tells certain of the things that you would read about if you were going to ask for the United States and Britain in prophecy. But let's go to the end of the article. Talks about the rise and fall and the birthright nations and what was promised to the house of Israel, those who the world, of course, has thought that the Jews are Israel. Well, they're one tribe. You know, they're brothers to all the other of the 12 sons, Ephraim and Manasseh making a total of 13 because Joseph had two sons. But you go all the way to the end and he says, I won't take more space here. This whole story is given in great detail in my forthcoming book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. It will be available in bookstores in March. That was 1980, and it became the most popular book that the work ever sent out. And by the way, make a note, Mr. Armstrong told people in The Plain Truth the way to get it is go to a bookstore. Just a small point. But already the noose is around our necks and is almost daily tightening. Skyrocketing inflation, devaluation of the dollar in all foreign markets, other economic ills are starting greatly to reduce our standard of living. I warn you, prepare greatly to reduce your standard of living. Even greater punishments are to follow. Well, here we are almost 31 years later. So most of God's people didn't do it. How many do you think did it in the world? Very few. Very few. Now, one of our ministers handed me something, and I want to illustrate a point, and this is where I'm going to probably make a fairly strong point here in a moment, but I want to lead in, because I'm going to read a number of scriptures. But I want to lead in with a story. I have heard periodically over the years, and as the church continues to grow, we're probably going to grow well over 30% this calendar year. That's phenomenal. We're one of the fastest growing organizations, I'm sure, of any kind in the world. And I have every reason to think we could grow 40 or more percent, maybe even up to 50% next year. I do believe that. But we're going to exceed the 30% that the Worldwide Church of God saw for 35 years. That's an extraordinary thing. Now, I want to just tell a little bit of a story. I love pets. I grew up with a lot of pets. You've heard me talk about some of them in my biography. Mr. Armstrong had a pet ferret. And when I went to visit him, the only time I ever visited him in his home in Arizona, he's now about 86 or 7 years old, he wanted to take me into his backyard and show me his ferrets. He'd gotten some more ferrets at that age. Nothing wrong with having a pet. I grew up with pets. I never had a ferret. I had one kid at school I thought was a ferret. But he wasn't. I'm pretty sure he was just a person with a unique shape. In any event, I hear about people who have lots of cats and lots of dogs, and I want to comment on that because we've got to start revisiting some things. I never had a cat growing up. I always had cats. Now, we had these two Persians at one point. I remember they're the most famous of my cats. My parents were scotch drinkers, so they named it Scotch and Soda. And one was a little darker and one was a little lighter. Someone in the neighborhood hated those cats and poisoned them, each of them separately, and then stretched them in our door dead. When I went out to open the door to go to school twice, two different mornings, there were my cats. I loved them, took care of them more than my older sister and younger brother. There were other cats, though. And at that time, we had two dogs. We always had at least two dogs. When I was a child, I do not remember where we did not have a Pomeranian, an inside dog, and outside was our collie, Sally, and that was more or less my dog. And I absolutely loved this three-legged dog who had her one leg ripped off by a mowing machine. I've told that story. She was running down the boulevard, and dog came home one day, and my mother saw the leg was torn right out of the shoulder, just like it was never there. And she ran down to the boulevard and grabbed this big, the biggest collie you ever saw in your life. I still have a picture of her sitting and only one leg out. But I didn't care. As a little kid, it was a dog. And as almost big as I was. I was about 3 and 4 in there. Loved dogs. You know, almost cost me my life, that dog. She had puppies, so we often saw puppies. I'm going to illustrate a point here. This is important. And I went out into the shed. My mother said, "Leave Sally alone, David." Well, that was a signal to go right to Sally and to check. I wanted to see my puppies. So I went in. My mother wasn't looking. Went in, couldn't see them because she had them on the other side, and she kind of growled at me a little bit. Never seen that. Again, I was 3. Might have been almost 4, my mother describing my age. But I got up on this bench right by a window to try to see and lost my balance and went head first through glass. And broke all the glass. All I did was cut myself here, though. I should have killed myself because I didn't pull back through like any 3 or 4 year old would, and I had all this glass around me. Just would have jabbed me everywhere. And I screamed. My mother came out, held my head, and plucked all the glass out, and then pushed me back through, went in and got me, and then took me to get the stitches. Hamsters, fish. I don't remember any time in my childhood where there was not a fish. Multiple kinds of fish. I'd save up and buy them at different times of my allowance. And a parakeet, Bluey. I remember coming home one day. I love this parakeet, Bluey. And came home one day, and my mother had almost arranged the dining room into a kind of a pet mortuary. And Bluey had died. And she had this thing over his cage and so forth. And I was shocked. I'd never seen a bird die. I was probably about 10, something like that. So special to me, I will not tell you his color. I'll give you a clue, though. It wasn't Blooie. All right, that's not the spelling. So if you can take that clue, you might come to the right conclusion. Hint, hint, he wasn't greeny or reddy or yellowy. I love pets. I love them. Later on, when we moved to a different house, outside, my big German Shepherd was Cappy, and in the house was our miniature collie, Penny. I could tell you the names of our dogs. When Cappy died, we got Cappy, too, because my dad had a dog named Cappy. It came from Captain. So I'm not against pets. I didn't have a lot of pets with my own children. We got a few dogs here and there, but with our different lifestyle, I had to be willing to give them up. My wife grew up, she rode a horse to school, rode it to school. Goats, chickens, pigs, whatever else. She'd go out and take the eggs in. But some people don't grow up that way. She had one of her friends was over staying for the weekend overnight, and she went out and got eggs from under the chickens. And this girlfriend had not seen that. Went and said, "Oh, I don't eat those. I don't eat those eggs." "You don't eat eggs?" "Oh, yeah, I eat our eggs. I eat eggs, but I get the kind that come from the store." Those are Comet. And I wouldn't eat an egg that came from a chicken. You get stuck. And so she wouldn't eat the eggs. Hard to believe. That's a true story. But, you know, dogs, cats, whatever else. So if I could have a dog or a cat or whatever, I would. Some of God's people today have 3, 4, 5, 6 cats similar numbers of dogs. Conservative cost for one dog per year, really conservative, not counting giving it to a kennel for $20 a day to go to the feast. Let me just say, a dog is a wonderful thing. You know, I never missed Rin Tin Tin, and I watched Lassie. Mine was Sally, and that was Lassie. Oh, I love to see that. You know, when Lassie would take on a lion that escaped from the circus, and you remember all those shows, and the lion would be outside, and Lassie would bark it away. So one of the ministers here at headquarters actually did a study using the average number of dogs and cats that the members here at headquarters have and costed it out. Now, the average cat costs about $288 per year. Now, please follow this important illustration. That yields, if you average it all out across the country, assuming that about 15% of households have cats, as is the case at headquarters, but only working off one cat, it costs our members over $22,000 a year for cats. Now, not quite as many have dogs at headquarters. Following the same principle, dogs cost about $480 per year, cats $288, dogs almost $200 more. The cost is almost $28,000 across the United States for the cost of dogs. Now, that assumes that, again, the people who have cats and dogs only have one or the other of each. Only one. One or the other, and then only one. You see, one or the other, and then only one. Now, many people have tremendous numbers of cats and dogs. Chances are God's people are spending hundreds of thousands of dollars, because I think the percentage of people having dogs and cats at headquarters is way low, because a lot of the staff don't have them. They don't have time. That's my personal opinion. I think probably more than 15% of people across the country have dogs and more than 20% cats. That's my guess. I might be wrong. Maybe it's high. But in the end, we'd be looking at a lot of people have many cats and dogs at a tremendous expense. And think about what that would do for the work if those funds came here. And I'm not saying everybody should get rid of all their dogs and cats, but some of you should, and all of you should get rid of a menagerie of them if that's what you have. I want you to think about that as an illustration. It's not a minor thing in light of what we're going to be talking about. Frankly, rather major in principle. There are things in the final generation you cannot do in the same way. I love to ride horses. I'd love to go riding a horse with my wife. I don't know if I'd... Because of my station, I'd be careful, my back's fused now. But again, it's an example of a change that has to come in the thinking of many of God's people, and it would benefit the work. Now let's start looking at a number of scriptures. Turn to Galatians chapter 5, because I'm setting us up, brethren, to close through the rest of the message with some profoundly important instruction. There's got to be a sea change in our thinking, and it has to start right now. Galatians chapter 5. And verse 22 talks about, but the fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, goodness, faith, meekness, temperance. Against such there is no law. The word for goodness, from which comes godness, in the sense godly, really in the Greek is better translated as beneficence. That's why you've maybe heard me say the best way to think of the fruit of the Spirit, there are only nine there, goodness is generosity or beneficence. It's the spirit of giving. That's what it is. One of the most profound things I ever heard Mr. Armstrong say was there are only two ways of life, give versus get. There were three things he said that struck me that did not seem doctrinal, and yet they were doctrinal. One is that everything in life is tied to cause and effect. Good causes, good effects. Bad causes, bad effects. It's a simple way of seeing everything that goes on in the universe, literally, and in your life and mine, the two trees. There's the tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And when you take the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you're destined to live a life that's a mixture of good and evil knowledge. And the third one was there are two ways of life, the give way and the get way. The vast majority live the get way. God's people live the give way. They are generous. Now, we're going to have to start to change our thinking in the way we look at contributing to the work. And I want you to keep that in the back of your mind as we start going forward. I gave a sermon on Clarion Call 3 years ago. I gave it November 3rd, 2007. And in a way, this is Clarion Call 2. A year ago, we had an article. I want to talk about some things. I have not moved one inch from the roughly, I thought then, perhaps about a maximum of 8 years left before the age is over. I'm aware that 8 minus 3 is 5. I haven't moved one inch from that. I have great difficulty understanding how this world and looking at Europe, at a certain point, the existing Pope's going to call fire down and it's all over. So if I have doubts, I don't see how we go 5 more years. But if we went 6 or 7 and we were wrong, okay, small difference in my mind. A lot of it, of course, hinges on the exact date for Solomon's Temple. You all understand that math. I've explained it to you. Now, let's go forward. Luke chapter 12. The Bible is literally filled, brimful, and running over with instruction from Christ that couldn't all be repeated in the Olivet prophecy and the three accounts we looked at. But it's so very big in the thinking of God in the form of Jesus Christ, only two God beings, that over and over he warned about certain things. Luke 12, verse 15, he said, "Take heed and beware of covetousness." Now, you'd think people would be if it's one of the Ten Commandments. It's one of the proofs that the true Jesus Christ of the Bible was not some rebellious, smart-aleck young man who came to do away with his father's law. He was the God of the Old Testament, the one Moses got the tablets from on the top of the mountain and came down with the tenth great law on it saying, "Thou shalt not covet." So he's reiterating it, expanded the law. "For a man's life consists not in the abundance of the things which he possesses." Try to find very many people who do not live like it does. A lot of people will probably tell you, "Oh, I know my life doesn't consist of the things that I possess," but then try to suggest they should either cut down their possessions, get rid of them, and you'll get nowhere. They live as though their life is how many toys they have. They line up in long lines when a new and improved cell phone comes out, and they'll find hundreds of dollars to get a phone that's better than the one they bought 12 or maybe only 6 months earlier. It's stunning. The latest PC. They have to have everything. They've got to keep up with the Joneses. A little ahead of them is even better. That's the way most people live their lives, that their life is exactly whatever they possess, and the goal is to see who can die with the most toys. You got to break that mindset. Strip down in your mind what you're able to live on. I had 3 children, and I was systematically underpaid by an evil man in Pasadena. And there were times I would go month after month after month. I trained and disciplined myself to do it. I still have every single one of the budgets I carried on my 3x5 card in my wallet, where I could go an entire month, feed my children, buy our children clothes once a year, and they wore hand-me-downs. I'd go $8. That was everything. And that was clothing, everything. That was what was left over for all the other entertainment, miscellaneous, go to the movies. You know, buy a USA Today once in a while, I had $8 left. And that was well into the time I lived in Wadsworth, Ohio. I know you can go without. I live in a lovely home now, but I know what it's like to live in a motel. I didn't come to where I am in the home I'm in, of which I own almost none of it, and I'll come to that story in a minute. It'll be an inspiring story, but I want you to come to realize you've got to come to recognize you can live on nothing. I grew up in a beautiful home. I thought about that when I walked away from my athletic career. That 4D scholarship offers, just picked the one I wanted. And other things. You think through when you're walking away, and you're training, and you grew up in a country club existence. I've learned exactly what Paul meant when he said you can abound and be abased. Everywhere and in all things I am instructed, both how to abound and be abased. Paul was a guy who could be on the Jewish Supreme Court, the Sanhedrin, which is really what it was, and live in a tent during most of his ministry. Job could have it all, lose it all, and get twice as much back. Either way, it's another day at the office. Abraham, incredibly wealthy, in the land of Ur, left and lived in tents the rest of his life. Scores and scores and scores of years. Stunning, really. And Isaac and Jacob did the same. Most of those God has used, Mr. Armstrong, three businesses crashed, and then 28 years of abject poverty. Joseph grew up in a good family. Then he's sold into slavery into Egypt, winds up in the can for 2 years for something he didn't do, and winds up the second most powerful guy in Egypt. Then there's Daniel, slave boy, third most powerful man in the most powerful empire, the head of gold under Nebuchadnezzar. You need to think through what you think you need to have, only starting with pets. Luke 6, let's stay right here in Luke. Go over to Luke chapter 6. Luke 6, 38, give and it shall be given unto you. Look, he really can't outgive God. When my father died, one of the most generous human beings I ever knew, grew up so unbelievably, just grindingly poor. My mother grew up just spectacularly wealthy, married this poor boy from way over on the other side of the track, so to speak. But my father came to success in many ways. And yet he was the most generous person, and after he died, I'm going through his papers, and he had a note written to himself. Randall, you can't outgive God. We still have it. Good measure, pressed down and shaken together. You want to give grain? Pack it down and give more to people. Don't fluff it up so you kind of chisel them a little bit. And running over shall men give unto your bosom. For with the same measure that you meet withal shall it be measured unto you. Solomon said, cast your bread on the waters, and after many days you'll take it up again. The thing about giving is you wind up getting more back. The give way of life is the single greatest get way of life you could ever live. If you want to live the get way of life at the pinnacle of how to do it, it's try to outgive God and watch him. It just bombs away. You give 10%, and even then God says, give 10%. You've robbed me in tithes and offerings, Malachi 3, 8 to 10. And the way he says, prove me. And he opens the windows of heaven, you wind up getting as a result of what you give. Acts 20 and verse 35, Paul quotes Christ, it is more blessed to give than receive. Now, receiving is a blessing. That's why it says it's more blessed to give than receive. The irony is you can't talk about your greatest blessings. Do you know that? You can talk about the lesser tier of blessings you have. I've explained this before. You can talk about things you were given. I received a blessing. But your greatest blessings, you can't go around your horn toot. Because it's more blessed to give. So that's a level of blessings you can't talk about. Other people will, though. Proverbs 27:2, let another's lips praise you and not your own. Now, you don't give, hope, and hate. Now, tell everybody. Will you blow a trumpet every chance you get? Tell them I gave because I'm not allowed to do it or I'll blow my reward. No, you wouldn't do that. I understand. You understand. Go back to Luke 12. Several verses are important for those who have greater substance going forward in God's work. We're at a time when people have to start to turn loose of what they have. Luke chapter 12, again, verse 48. But he that knew not and did commit things worthy of stripes shall be beaten, Luke 12, with few stripes, comparing two servants. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him shall be much required. Now, I'm going to speak directly in a way I don't think I ever have. In the first of three verses, to those with substance that others, those who are the weak of the world, do not have. You have a requirement from your God to give more. And now is the time. If the last 4 hours prior to this point in the sermon, or 4.5 hours by now, has not convinced you, there is no point. It's an utter fool's errand to hold it back toward an end when you'll never get to use it. Your kids aren't going to get to use it. Your grandchildren aren't going to get to use it. And neither is your wife or your husband when you flee. If you've been given much, it is required that you give back. Turn to 1 Timothy chapter 6. Now, this is not just a message to the wealthy. They get three verses in about 5 hours. 1 Timothy chapter 6. The Bible says these things, so I am duty-bound to say them. And I'll come in a moment. I'm going to talk a little bit about myself. My circumstances have changed somewhat, and I want to talk about it. I did it 3 years ago. I'm a very, very open person. My parents said I always was. I'm not about to change now, so I'm going to be very open with you here in a minute, but we're not ready to get there yet. In 1 Timothy 6, there are several places where it talks about the classic way people view money and possessions. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 5 talks about perverse disputings of men of corrupt minds. Now, that's an interesting statement. And destitute of the truth. How do you know a corrupt mind destitute of the truth? Supposing that gain is godliness, who can die with the most toys? From such, turn away. But godliness with contentment is great gain. Now, I've preached this before, given whole sermons on it down through the years, and it is important that we all understand something. The world would say, the more you have, the more you have. God's math, God's mind, the equation he has is the more you're willing to not have more, the more you've gained. What is contentment? It's saying, I don't need any more. You've just gained greatly. Now, that is not the way human nature thinks, but it's the way God gives and thinks. Get that in your mind. If you're holding back and hoarding, for what? If you didn't believe the last 4 hours, then I guess maybe you've got your own reason, but let's keep going on. For we brought nothing into this world, and certain we can carry nothing out. Do you believe that? And having food and clothing, let us be therewith content. Could you get by on $8 after you paid all your bills? Would you be willing to do that? I didn't know if I could do it. And I found that when I did it, I grew stronger and stronger. I could feel myself building character. And it almost became a thing of pride. I had to be careful that I could suppress a desire to spend any money. When I spent any of the $8 that was left over after my kids were going to college in 90, 91, and 92, and in New York, in some ways was even tougher. I couldn't make ends meet. I had to borrow off a credit card over the years just waiting for God to deliver me. And he did, and it always worked out toward an end I couldn't have imagined back then. But they that will be rich fall into temptation and a snare and into many foolish and hurtful lusts. You doubt it? Walk through them all today and see how many things there are to lust after. Many things. Which drown men in destruction and perdition, which is physical and spiritual damnation, eternal damnation. For the love of money, not money, the love of money is a root, indefinite article in the Greek, of all evil, which while some coveted after, you know, the old say, oh, money isn't everything. The other 2%'s happiness. Ha, ha, ha. You know, big joke. That's one of the jokes out there. They have erred from the faith and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. The way of transgressors is hard. Those that go after money, want to make big money, build their business, make their fortune under the sun, a lot of problems ensue. But you, O men of God, flee these things. Verse 17. Paul was an apostle writing a senior minister, an evangelist, Timothy. I'm commanded to do the same thing in a way. Paul speaks to me as much as Timothy and to all of the rest of our ministers. Charge them that are rich in this world that they be not high-minded nor trust in uncertain riches. I'm watching people just buying gold. I think I mentioned this last week. And I can already see it being set up, the whole society being set up to cast their gold and silver in the streets because you can't eat it. But in the living God, who gives us richly all things to enjoy. Well, I earned it. Listen, we're tenants on God's plantation called earth, all of us. And we're slaves. We're slaves on God's plantation. We're called bond slaves in the scriptures. We're bought with a price. We're living sacrifices. That they do good. The wealthy have a special obligation to do good. That they be rich in good works, ready to distribute. Ready for what? When the opportunity and the occasion comes. And I'm telling you, to those with any substance in God's church, the occasion is now. If you are obedient to this verse, it is time to distribute. Willing to communicate. Laying up in store for themselves when they do these things a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on eternal life and not physical things. Now, I'm speaking bluntly here. We're not a big church. Those with substance have to dig deeper. Matthew 19, here's another time Christ talked. Now, we often turn to this particular chapter as proof that Christ said the commandment should be kept. And it's a good reason to do it, but there's another message here. Verse 16, and behold, one came and said to him, good master, what good thing shall I do that I may have eternal life? And he said to him, why call you me good? If you will enter into life, keep the commandments. Which ones? Christ cited 5 of the 10 commandments, which people think Christ did away with. You have to keep the commandments to receive eternal life. Why are millions of Christian ministers, in quotes, around the world and saying you don't have to keep the law, the very Christ who said to keep it and to have eternal life nailed it to the cross? The very Christ who said in Matthew 5, heaven and earth will pass before a jot or tittle of the law would pass away, or the prophets, then nailed them to the cross. The very same Christ. Couldn't remember what he'd said and done. Well, verse 20, the young man said to him, all these things have I kept from my youth up. What lack I yet? Jesus said to him, if you will be perfect, the guy was covetous, go and sell that you have and give to the poor, and you shall have treasure in heaven, and come and follow me. This guy had a problem. When the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Look at what he gave up. Now here comes one of the most profound statements in the Bible for those who have wealth. Verily I say unto you that a rich man shall hardly, hardly enter into the kingdom of heaven, the kingdom of God. And again I say unto you, for emphasis, twice, it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God. Proves the kingdom of heaven and the kingdom of God are the same thing. The disciples were shocked. When his disciples heard it, they were exceedingly amazed, saying, who then can be saved? Now, in the book of Acts, it says this. I want to change gears a little bit. Just three verses I wanted to cover. Initially, when the church was born, 3,000 baptized, Pentecost, AD 31. It says, after they were, that they continued, verse 42, Acts 2, 42, they continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship. Verse 43, breaking of bread. And fear came upon every soul, and many wonders and signs were done by the apostles. And all that believed were together. Not a lot of splinters or different groups, denominations or whatever. And had all things common. And sold their possessions and goods and parted them to all men as every man had need. Now that's an amazing thing. Because here you've got 3,000 people who barely know each other and they're so on fire. Everybody throws everything into a community chest. Can you imagine the collective mindset, the thinking, the mold and model by which they were living that would have permitted them to do that so early to complete strangers? But they did. And tremendous miracles and other things came as a result. Well, the church continued to grow. And you find one more time, when you turn over to chapter 4, one more time, other miracles, gospels being preached, there's tremendous persecution, the people are bonding together, and you come to verse 29, and now, Lord, behold their threatenings, and grant unto your servants, Peter speaking, that with all boldness they may speak your word, by stretching forth your hand to heal, and that signs and wonders may be done by the name of your holy servant. It says child, it should say your holy servant, Jesus. And when they had prayed, the place was shaken, where they were assembled together, and they were all filled with the Holy Spirit, and they spoke the word of God with boldness. And the multitude of them that believed were of one heart and of one soul. Neither said any of them that aught of the things which he possessed was his own, but they had all things common. Voluntarily, this wasn't communism, with great power gave the apostles witness of the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and great grace was upon them all. Neither was there any among them that lacked. Think of the whole world going forward. Could this happen again as the horsemen ride in other parts of the world before, in effect, they are seen to, in a sense, continue on into the lands of Israel with what we really know as the fifth seal, the great tribulation, and thirds die in the way they do, as we understand? America is the breadbasket of the world. Canada, we are the ones that are the wealthiest. Neither was there any among them that lacked, for as many as were possessors of lands or houses sold them and brought the prices of the things that were sold. Exactly what I called for in the clarion call. Oh, did our enemy say, what are you doing? What? How can you do that? Well, there's a little detail. Follow the Bible. The entire church did it and laid them at the apostles' feet. They knew how God's government worked. And distribution was made unto every man according as he had need. The rest of the ministry would have known to do that. And Joseph, who by the apostles was surnamed Barnabas, which is being interpreted the son of consolation, a Levite and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. And then it goes into the story of Ananias and Sapphira, who played a deceitful game, but wanted to be seen as very generous. In the place of safety, you know we're going to have all things common. How could it be any other way? So I'm here to announce the church is going to move to a period where we have all things common. The only question is not whether, it's whether it happens at the place of safety or circumstances show we need to do it before. That's the only question. I don't have the answer to that. I don't know yet. But I'm going to mention it because there are going to be a lot of people who have need. Famine and pestilence is smiting the world. We have no brethren in Haiti. What if we did? Look at Matthew 8 and verse 20. Look at the example that Jesus Christ set. Most people don't think of this. Matthew 8 and verse 20. Well, let's pick up verse 18. When Jesus saw great multitudes about him, he gave commandment to depart to the other side, and a certain scribe came and said, "Master, I will follow you whithersoever you go." And Jesus said to him, "The foxes have holes, and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has not where to lay his head." Do you understand? That's the Savior you follow. That's like Abraham and Paul in tents. Most of us have homes. Another fellow said, "Well, let me go bury my father." Christ, to illustrate a point, said, "Follow me and let the dead bury the dead. Your spiritually dead brothers and sisters will take care of your dad. Your dad won't know you weren't there." It's an extraordinary time. It was a different time, Christ's first coming. The foxes have holes, the birds have nests, but the Son of Man has not where to lay his head. How would you feel if that was the way you, when you're the God of the universe, and you made all the things that all the houses on earth were constructed with? The stories could, frankly, go on and on in that regard. There are so many examples in the Bible. You could turn over to Hebrews chapter 11, and I'll just conclude before I go on to other things with this. Hebrews chapter 11, the faith chapter. The end of the chapter, all these different examples cited. Verse 32, "What shall I say more?" Paul writes the Hebrews. Hebrews 11:32, "For the time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak and Samson and Jephthah, of David and Samuel and the prophets, who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire." Christians in most other ages died violently. We're promised protection. That comes at a price. Doing the work is not your ticket to the place of safety, but it is close, as analogies go. Verse 36, "Others had trial of cruel mockings and scourgings, yet moreover of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned, sawn asunder," Isaiah from the crotch up, "were tempted, slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves of the earth." You think doing the work is that hard? It's a cushy job compared to what others do. That's why Christ will send into the great fire of the tribulation those who won't even do that. That's a privilege. I can't imagine doing anything else. I just can't imagine wanting to do anything else. How do you think the work's going to be done? The government has a printing press. We don't. The government thinks that taxpayers are a giant ATM machine. We don't have an ATM machine where we can go just take money. And we have to realize the work of God runs on the mammon of this world. Mr. Armstrong thundered every single co-worker letter for decades, almost 60 years, the importance of sacrificing. I've even tried to use his words. We spent a tremendous amount of money helping a lot of people go to the feast this year because the church is growing so fast. Here at the other end of the state, United is collapsing. They announced last week they're downsizing because they haven't grown in 15 years. They're collapsing, and their revenue shrinking. We grow 30% in the last year, so naturally, a lot of people needed assistance to go to the feast. And while I'm talking about it, let me mention third tithe. Every third and sixth year in a seven-year cycle, the seventh year of release, we are to pay an additional tithe for the widows, orphans, strangers, and needy, and so forth. It is vitally important going into this reset time after the feast, generally when we reset to a new and higher number, that greater needs can be met because people are faithful in God's commanded third tithe. So I'll say that at this point as well. So now we're talking the loss of Holy Day offerings, September. No, we're not bankrupt. Don't misunderstand me. I have never borrowed. Mr. Armstrong did borrow, and he would repay it. It's too dangerous an economy to do that. But I will before the work would slow down. Because our credit rating is so good, we do have a $200,000 credit line that we could use if we needed to. in an emergency. It is available to us. The bank likes us, but I don't want to use that. But I would if I had to. I would, as Mr. Armstrong did. I have not looked at the Clarion call notes. I pulled them out, saw them this morning for the first time. Here are my notes, incredibly extensive notes that I went through in those two-part sermon of 3 years ago. And just wanted to remind myself this morning of things that I'd said. I usually don't go back and study my own notes. And the brethren get to hear my sermons more than I do. I hear my sermon when I deliver it. I don't have the time to go back and listen to a lot of them, but I wanted to see some of the things that I had said and just kind of refresh myself. I mean, this is the longest series of notes in some ways I had ever given. I even quoted, prepare to greatly reduce your standard of living. And I went through all kinds of things. So I'm going to just tell you again where we are, and we need help, and we need it right now. And I'm going to call a fast after everybody else in the world has heard the sermons. I started last time, 3 years ago, by telling you my circumstances. I do not believe I can ask you to sacrifice if I do not set the lead. Mr. Armstrong at times, and I've read them to you, would be very open with the brethren about what he did personally in the early years. We're past the point where what I once had but don't anymore can be used. Now, I gave you my background. All the other leaders of the Splinters and down through the other leaders out there, they all have fleet cars and other things. I've never done that. I have one car. I don't have two cars. And my son was visiting the other day and said, Dad, you only have one car? And he answered, one car. That's all I need. I don't need two cars. And the last car I had, I drove 10 years in 1 month. And at a point, I realized, no, I need to change. I need a new one. So a couple years ago, 2.5 years ago, I guess, I got another one. I got another inheritance in January. And here's what I did with it. And I'm asking you to start considering what you're going to do. More of us. Some have been very generous. I immediately gave 25% of it. It was a nice chunk. I took a little over 60% of it and paid off what I'd given that I mentioned 3 years ago I still had, including I was finally able to pay off the costs of my first wife's death. Paid that off in January this year. I kept about 13% of my inheritance. I still have it. I refinanced my house, and I had it appraised, and I found out my house lost $125,000 in value. I'm not underwater, doing fine. I couldn't care less. What difference does it make? I still live in it. It's still the same house, whether I own it outright or owe the bank more than it's worth. I'm making the payments, so I'm perfectly happy. I couldn't care less, but I'm paying down, and the value of the home is chasing me south, and it's been catching me. And that's life, but I have no second mortgage. We don't turn in most of our expenses. Don't need to. I'm not going to. I'm certainly not worried about blowing my reward by telling you, but let me say this for dramatic effect. If I did blow my reward by having told you what I just did about my inheritance, it would be well worth it if that's the way God counted it. Again, I don't think he will. I don't think that's the way he thinks, but if it were, I'm happy to if it means a lot of you will be inspired to do what you can do. You don't have to tell people what you do. The business office will know, and that's it. Now, that's the first thing I'm going to tell you. However, because things are serious, I'm going to say some more things. The Council of Elders and certain ones in my family are going to quote Paul in 1 Corinthians 16. This will tell you something, and the brethren may be able to stop it, but starting here in about 5 days, I checked that, well, actually, it's already in effect. My wife's entire salary, the gross value of it, we're going to start holding back to give to the work if others don't come through, plus about 10% of my salary. I know I can live on nothing. I'm going to do it. I'm going to pull back, and we're going to, all of us on the council, the entire council is in this with me. We're going to set the pace. They've all been incredibly generous. They've submitted a number to me. And we're going to be able, on the council, each month, hold back somewhere out of our personal spending. Not because we make a ton of money, between $10,000 and $11,000 a month. And it's going to go into a savings account. And we're going to give it to the work if we have to, if something doesn't kick in. Because we cannot pull back the first commission. That's just the first thing I want to explain. We cannot do that. I will not do that. I'll do anything necessary because if we do that, we destroy our ability to grow the work. And we won't please God either. Now, there's a reason God raised up two businessmen, one in the 20th century and one in the 21st century, to do the work. I understand business models. To most of God's people, I am an apostle, but I'm also the chief executive officer of the second corporation I've run. And I saw 11 corporations build in my family, some of them big. And I know how to run companies. I saw how to do it, and I inherited my father's company. And I learned a lot. Mr. Armstrong was an advertising man, but also a businessman, but an advertising man for a reason. You had to have businessmen at the end of the age to do these giant works. And I know if we destroy the business model and we stop advertising at an ever greater amount, we might as well shut the doors. It's the dumbest possible way to save money. And so here we are poised to advance and expand our budgets. I mean, we are so poised, it's unbelievable. But I'm going to tell you right now, in the next 12 months, we need $750,000. That seem a lot? That's not. Now, let me pause and make some fairly extensive comments at this point. We have three great needs today. $750,000 will not address all of them. But number one, they will dramatically increase the size of the first commission necessary now. That's number one. It will also come close to ensuring that the next round of ministers in 2011 will be able to be hired. We are planning to hire in 1 year. I'll probably reference that again, but we are able to do those two things. The third great need would be a building. A building would be built. And I'll come back to that in a different context later on. That would not fit in the $750,000. That would be closer to what happens if this response in 2010 to this clarion call part two were commensurate with 3 years ago. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. So I hope that you will think about that, and then I will give some other numbers later. As we continue, think in terms of how ancient Israel, carnal-minded ancient Israel's response was to the need to build a tabernacle in the wilderness and later a temple in Jerusalem. These people without God's Spirit, not close to the end of the age, not working through the period where the four horsemen were riding and under tremendous persecution besides, where there was shortness of time, they were unbelievably generous in their response, and on other occasions as well. But when Moses rose up and said, we need an offering, people came forward, and what they gave was shocking. So if they can do that without God's Spirit, in much more benign world circumstances, to say the least, what can we do against the realities of our time? If we think, how generously can we respond with this extraordinary obligation upon us? So we start with the council, what we're going to do, and a couple others who are very close to me, not explained to anybody else until now. How far would we go? I'll cut all the ministers' salaries in half and tell their wives to all go get a job. We're not going to pull the work back. There's not enough time. Listen, I saw Mr. Armstrong in austerity years in 1970 at the end of my junior year. Remember, I went to the field as the only ministerial assistant in the entire world, all three campuses, because I wanted to go to the field, and I got a job to get training. That's the only way I could get it. Went to Indianapolis, Indiana in 1970. I saw austerity. 2 years later, I was laid off right after my wife had a baby, and I went through a very tough year. I've learned that you can even survive a layoff, and I'll lay people off before the work will not go forward. I don't want to do that, though. I have no plans to do that. Now, whether we tell the minister's wives to go out and get a job and then send us what you earn and live on your husband's salary like you're doing now because the workloads are not yet that great in the field, then I don't know. I don't know exactly how we would do it. We have a whole series of things that we are prepared to do if we needed to. Quite a series of things. I know that many of our members do from time to time. This is back in 1970 as we were entering a severe crisis, worse than what we are. Buy such things as a new TV set or dishwasher on monthly payments. Perhaps some will want to put off such a purchase and let those monthly payments go to repay a loan at the bank that will supply God's work with immediate cash, which is in serious, all caps, immediate need. Immediate cash in all caps. coworker letter, March 30, 1970. Some of you feel you're not in a position to take part in this plan for immediate, all caps, extra cash to the work, or feel you don't want to. Don't have to explain. I do not expect it unless you really want to and are able. I'm not high pressuring you to do this. At that point, maybe there's 45 years left. Today, maybe five. But I'm not high pressuring you. And I'm not going to check up on anybody and ask what they do. He quotes the treasurer that God's work has serious needs right now, all caps. And I have participated to the best of my ability. And then names another minister, Will, and all of God's leading ministers and executives here at headquarters. So we're doing the same thing. I saw two austerity years, 24 months apart. We felt many of you brethren would be willing and glad to make this sacrifice of borrowing whatever you are able, giving it to the work, and paying it back monthly yourself, in addition to continuing to send in your tithes and offerings. I'm not asking you go borrow money yet and give it to the work. But would some think I shouldn't? Or that you'd be going too far? Mr. Armstrong did that. I'm not coming to that yet. We're short of that. We're talking about assets that aren't going to go anywhere. They're not going to go to other generations, as in all previous ages. Brethren, together, we can really do wonders through the power of earnest and believing prayer, with fasting especially. That's why we're going to fast. We've been talking about this since August. So please pray that God will bless our efforts, bless our thinking and our planning, that He will bless the development of the new book and the audios that will begin. Brethren, I might just cut in and tell you we're having a tremendous explosion in statistics in all areas. We've been exploding with growth since the feast even. It's been very exciting to see. Never have more people been watching the current world to come in video. We haven't even started the audios. We're at the greatest rate we've ever been, and we're poised to soar soon, as in November, way beyond where we are now. We do need all of us praying together in this regard. Understand that God can bless us in a bad economy. God isn't bound where I can't work in a bad economy. I need a good economy to bless my church. God needs prayers to bless His church. Then He needs a response in the hearts and minds of His people. A bad economy doesn't mean anything to God. God knew at the end of the age all the things that were going to come weren't going to be because it was good economic times, never mind great. It's going to be bad. That's what's going to give birth to the rise of the beast power, the false prophet and the beast working together in Europe. Bad economic times. So the end of the age was always going to be God working through and with His church in difficult, challenging times, and we are certainly in those. Over half the people in the Restored Church of God were not in the church 3 years ago when we had the clarion call. I just want to show you. We had the clarion call. Call it beginning almost exactly 3 years ago. Everybody else is going to hear these sermons in a couple of weeks. So it pretty much lines up. The response was unbelievable. Beyond my wildest imagination 3 years ago. I couldn't believe the generosity of God's people. Frankly, having looked at the list, I have a list of the amounts that came in from different households. I don't want to know the names, but I asked for a list of amounts. I've never seen it until just a couple days ago, actually. And just the amounts. One family heard that clarion call sermon and gave $293,000. Another one sent $125,000, another one $102,000. I remember my daughter came rushing into my office, just had opened an envelope, and there was a check for $100,000. The person who sent it never said it was coming. We had never seen a check over $10,000. Another person, $268,000, $112,000, $88,000, $30,000. These are just different households. They figured out how to help. 94, 80, 73, 60, 50, 49, 40, 40, 33, 30, 25, and down it goes. All those numbers are in the thousands, and many others are in the thousands besides. Individual households, I don't know if they gave it once or multiple times, I don't know. There's no names. And it utterly changed the work. Utterly changed the work. It's why we were able to do so much more. Start a college. Have a ministry around the world. Because as they gave and were getting ready to go ahead and build a building, the economy collapsed. Couldn't do the building. Banks all got scared. So we had this money and it allowed us to expand the work in a powerful way. Add to the staff. Add feast sites. Give away literature more freely. Unbelievable. And it lasted and lasted and lasted and lasted. And I made a decision to overspend 3 years ago. Actually, a little over 2 years ago, because we kept saving for a while. Now, that statement requires some explanation. Why would you overspend? Well, we had a huge reserve. In this age, we couldn't sit on it, so I made a decision for a time to overspend against reserves, not to borrow. That's a very different kind of overspending, like the federal government in so many countries. This was against our reserves. I knew we could do it for quite a while. Well, we can't do it anymore, but we could for a while. And we must have about 9 to 10 months to grow into our shoes. We need additional supplementary income. And hope that background helps you understand why I would make the only possible decision that anyone could make in my circumstances. Remember, we have not borrowed. Mr. Armstrong borrowed, and he asked the brethren to borrow and send money. We haven't done either of those things. We've never borrowed. But I had a huge reserve. We're sitting here. Am I going to say, oh, we're rich and increased with goods, have need of nothing, sit on it, let's protect ourselves, let's do exactly what the United Church of God and others do with big reserves when we're not a large organization? Of course I couldn't do that, and I know you would all understand that. Over $2 million came in 3 years ago, over a period of time. A much bigger church, 2 years later, we wrote an article, gave about a seventh as much. And again, we miscalculated. Now, I said that I would return at a point to the big picture of our needs and mention again the subject of a building. Let's look at what would happen if a much bigger church today, for every one who was in the church 3 years ago, there's more than one more person here today. So over twice as big in that regard. If we all gave at the exact same rate in 2010 as we did in 2007, just responded the exact same way on a per capita basis, we would build a building. We'd be announcing a building in 90 days. Now, we don't have to give more, but just if we give the same amount, take $2.14 million, which came in the first Clarion call, double that to about $4.3 million, and we would not only have a building, but we would have the other things. We would ensure the continued expansion of the ministry, which has a powerful effect on the growth of the church because of the presence of local shepherds. And the work would take off in a host of other ways that I mentioned also. We're poised to do that. Now, ponder this for a moment. Let's suppose we had $5 or $6 or $7 million come in. Maybe somebody out there will hear this. And they'll be moved and realize they have that money. I don't know who they would be. I don't track all the names of who comes into the church. And if I did, I wouldn't know their worth. So it may be somebody out there with ears to hear. We could, within a year, be on national television. I mean that. It only costs about $400,000 or $500,000 per year to go on WGN, the last superstation in America, that will take religious programming. All the others won't. And we need maybe about $300,000 in equipment if we go with used equipment. So for well under $1 million, call it another $750,000, we can start into television. That would get us 1 year. And every year after that would be less than $750,000. That would be, again, in addition to the $750,000 I mentioned before. We can begin to pursue some of those ads I talked about at the opening of the sermon, part two. Earlier this afternoon with Fox News. There's so much that could be done if just a few more millions came that would so prime the pump and just rocket forward and up the size of the work. It's hard to imagine, but we just have to see what comes in and who is moved. I don't even want to think about what would happen if someday God superfunded us in a huge way beyond the kinds of numbers I'm talking about. Because our capability and our efficiency, our focus, our training, the existence of the greatest cache of literature the world has ever seen when God has been working through human beings. We have the staff, the currently existing ministry structure. We have protocol and policy. The truth of God is in place. The college is cranking out students. We're so ready. Again, I find it difficult to choose the words to say. Now, Mr. Armstrong used to give a lot more numbers, and I don't, because I don't want our enemies to know. I want to keep them guessing. I made a decision 11 and a half years ago. I was never going to announce our attendance or our income. I probably told you more now than I ever have. But the clarion call was a little over $300,000 a year ago and over $2 million, a much smaller church, 2 years earlier. I know that a year ago we were into the problems of the downturn. We need a tremendous amount. Now, God has called over the period of the last year or two, and I don't know, some of the newer people that were with us, maybe they didn't understand or didn't, because there was no sermon a year ago as there was 3 years ago, two sermons. But it is crucial, brethren, people respond. We need a tremendous amount of money, and we need it in a hurry. We're not going under, but you don't have to worry about us going under. But I don't want to reach a point where we have to make cuts. I mean, I sit and I think of our staff. We've got five people on staff who are being paid minimum wage. A couple of them are part-time, but some of them are full-time, minimum wage. Those people need raises, as do certain others. The idea of raises is out of the question, but it doesn't mean that the need isn't there. The need for raises is very much in the question. The ability to give it is out of the question at this time, but could quickly re-enter. The first of the year is typically when those things would happen. So I'll let you be aware of that. And I'm, again, trying to be as open as I can about everybody's circumstances. We've had a lot have come in and volunteered. And I know what they're thinking right now, because at a certain point, we'd have to lay people off. I don't want to do that. And they're thinking, I could lose right now, because I'll tell you what's in their mind, and how could it be otherwise? I've been there. My heart goes out to them. I'm sorry that in a way they have to hear this, and I hope you'll ensure in a way that they continue to help us do the work, because the funds wouldn't be real helpful if you don't have the people to do the work. And I know what they're thinking. Thinking, ooh, do I hold back because I could lose my job? And then if too many do that, even on the staff, it could become a little bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy. Now, we can do certain things. Unfortunately, you know, the way it works in the work, and it's the way it is we sort of reload at the spring and fall holy days with over 20% of our annual income coming in those two spikes. We come to those crucial budgetary mile markers, and we kind of reload and buy ourselves another 5 to 7 months, depending upon when the holy days fall, to grow further into our shoes to the point where we are able to add more weight in all that we do. But those are reloading points that are crucial. And one very big one is about 11 months out at next year's feast. Now, of course, all of that's abrogated if we have a marvelous response to this very message. But in our current frame of thinking, that's where we are. That's a very big mile marker or point of reload where we think everything is fine from that point going forward. But again, as I said, we could be fine in 30 or 60 days if we get a tremendous response. Now, I realize what we're asking for here probably can't come that fast, but whatever length of time it is, you understand the point that I'm making here. All of the plans going forward and the current circumstances go away. They're abrogated. They vanish if we get a great response now, because the needs in the work are so great, really, to go forward and expand the work now. Now, let me also say this another way so there's no misunderstanding the point. We're going to have a difficult 11 months if we do not continue to grow at an even faster rate. In other words, it's like we're jet-propelled, but we've got to add a couple more rockets to us to go even faster, because we just don't have the time. We've got all the tools, ministers, people. We have another whole round of ministers and cities where we want to put them in a year. Our ministry is doing a phenomenal job. We can't stop sending them church inquiries because we pull back our marketing efforts, our advertising efforts to do the work. The advertising man and me and Mr. Armstrong, the advertising man, would know you can't do that. But I'm willing, if we had to, cancel camp next summer. I'll delay the conference till after the feast when the Holy Day offerings come in. I'm trying to just tell you, I'd do anything. I watch people follow that false, deceived prophet in Oklahoma, and he squeezes every dime out of people. I'm not trying to do that. And then the other extreme is they're collapsing on the other end of the state. God is working in one place on planet Earth. You all understand that. Now, here's an idea. If every last person in the work, and they're all going to hear this, give exactly, this is just for openers, those who have no resources, like your pastor general who got a couple of inheritances when I never really had a savings account. And I basically paid back with the second inheritance what I'd given, what I borrowed on the first one, when I gave on the first clarion call and earlier. And I gave all through the years prior to that, because I did have a business until I couldn't run it anymore, and I practically gave it to my son. But let's say everybody wants to join in. If every last household that tithes, every single one, co-workers and donors won't hear this, but if everyone wants to tithe 15% extra, you give $100 from now on, give $115. Sell three cats. Turn some lights off. Do what I did the entirety of my children's childhood. They wore hand-me-downs from their cousins. Find a way, if you give $200, give $230. It would immediately take our income up 15%. But don't do it for 1 month. Do it for life. And 15% is a minimum. So if your normal tithes and offerings now are $500 a month, a couple more illustrations, you'd now give $575. If they're 1,000, let's say, some of you may give that much. I'm sure we have a few. Now you'd give $1,150. It's not 15% of your income. You're adding maybe another like 1.5% of your income, which takes your $100 to 115, because 100 is 10%. 15 more dollars would be 11.5% of your total income. I want to say this so that you don't misunderstand. It is a profound difference. 20% would be a tremendous big difference to the work's income. And there's all kinds of little ways to find it in your spending. My wife and I are looking again. We're having a ball. I told the council, you'll never have more fun in your life than if you lay this aside and you'll find out. You know, we have to endure hardness as good soldiers, all of us. And it starts at the top. The fat cat ministers of this world, I've read in recent programs, you'll be hearing what I say, God says he has in store for them, who fed themselves instead of God's flock. I'm not in this for the money. But I've never given my books to the work, I suppose. I could have gone out and marketed them, and I don't know where it would have gone. I see some of the cheap tracts and junk that are called books that are popular, and it's amazing. I never was in this for the money. If you were planning to give in the ongoing clarion call, please rethink and go further. If you weren't planning to give or thought you gave 1 or 2 or 3 years ago, do it again in a bigger way. I could go on and on with the incredible numbers. All the way down to one person gave $32, they may get a bigger reward than somebody who gave $100,000. It depends on the widow's mites. God knows how to value those things. I'll never say that wasn't important. All kinds of little teeny amounts. And loads of people, $5,000 and $10,000, I don't know how they did it. One person, the lowest I think in this recent clarion call, somebody gave $1. Maybe it's a person who had nothing and had to go shovel snow, a widow lady to get it, I don't know. It's to whom much is given, much is required. Charge them that are rich in this world. And you know the rest of the verse. It's time to be ready to distribute. Now, that's the inspiring part. I pray you will understand there is nothing to hold it back for. I know one of the wives on the council is going out to get a job to contribute the money. Here's one for you. What if God's people were unbelievably, just unbelievably generous? Let me tell you an amazing blessing. The land that we had on option, we had to let it go. It's not moving. They dropped the price, $500,000. They've now dropped the total price because of some other price drops. Before, when we dealt with them, they now dropped the price of the land one half. And it's sitting over there now with a road built right up to it. It's just sitting there waiting. They're willing to let us or someone practically take it from them because of the economic circumstances that land prices are in now. What if a huge response came? They'll even sell it to us on land contract because banks will not finance land that's unimproved. The guy said, wait, he wants to move it. That's just a thought. Now, it's not in any way in my mind, but I'm going to throw it out there because the price of this absolutely incredible land is so ridiculously low. I mean, it's just, I can't believe it. Just think if we'd bought the land earlier, before we had to let our option lapse, we would have paid a much higher price, $500,000. it appears God has intervened in a marvelous way, a miraculous way, let us out of the option. Now, of course, others can buy it and we can lose it, but the price has dropped and it still has not moved for several months. So even if we couldn't build the building, we could at least secure the land. That would be easy to do at this wonderful low price. So put that in your thinking as you plan ahead. Fundraising ideas going forward. The Holy Day offerings, they're just much more important than you realize, brethren. Now, I'm trying as hard as I can to say all the things I can so that you can appreciate what is at stake. We walk by faith and not by sight. We don't know the day or the hour, but I will tell you, if the leaves are not shooting forth now, then I don't know spring. And I've planted probably 500 trees and 1,000 bushes in my life. I understand things that grow. I don't build things very well. I wouldn't want you to see the first doghouse I built for Cappy. Might have worked well for Bluey, now that I think of it. When God comes, will he find faith on the earth? Christ said, the Son of Man comes. I don't know. It's an individual thing. One of the things that needs mention, and this is encouraging, I do hear reports of some who are coming out of retirement and getting jobs. Thank you. Thank you. They're rioting in France, rioting in Greece and other places because they've come to believe in a sense of entitlement. The reason America is doomed, in one sense, absolutely doomed, is because you cannot take things away from people you gave them for so long that they now believe you owe it to them. 99 weeks for unemployment? I remember when it was 13 weeks. It's a totally different mindset. It just cannot creep into the church. You know things they don't know. So I'm glad to hear that. I hope more people who are in retirement will continue to come out. You take a look at ultimately what is Babylon. The merchants of Babylon, I gave a sermon explaining about that. Now, when God says come out of Babylon, it means come out of materialism. Yes, of course, it means the whole religious, political, economic, military system that has existed for 2,000 years and, you know, in seven resurrections, 1,500 years since Justinian. I understand that. It's all of that. But what that charismatic leader hoped for in Europe is to give them economic security so the merchants of Babylon can continue. We live in an age when people want their Starbucks coffee and they want their gourmet this and their gourmet that. I always thought McDonald's coffee, now I'm just trying to illustrate a point, was good coffee. But I used to think that it was. And then I drank Starbucks and got used to it, and all my life I thought McDonald's was fine. Now I drink McDonald's and it tastes like death water. I don't know. The Grim Reaper made it. It's horrible. But you change, and you think you need something else, and you don't. You don't. I would ask you to consider all these things. This is another clarion call. Time has moved on. You think the next 5 years is long or short? I don't know what you think. How long did the last 3 years go? Maybe we have three more years. Maybe we have 6 years. We know that it will be less than 6,000 years. The work will be cut short. And if we continue to do God's work, then there won't be a hair of our head that will be disturbed. Now look, I don't know how I could be stronger. When has any series of sermons, this is just a question, one of the closing comments that I want to pose to you. When has any sermon in any age, think about all that you've heard since last Sabbath, said more horrific things, talked about more awful, terrifying things, and stronger in impact? I certainly have never given any. I've given a lot of prophetic sermons in my life, probably more than any minister who ever lived, literally. I am certain of that. Now is the time. There will be three groups. There'll be those, of course, in the church who are, we found so doing, you know, before I get to the three groups, be those who are found so doing and those who won't. I learned in the Worldwide Church of God, and I think I said this last week, that the great majority of people did not have God's Spirit. And that was in the Philadelphian age. And most of those who did grew lukewarm. You could not be Philadelphian outside the Worldwide Church of God, but being in it didn't automatically mean that you were. You cannot be Philadelphian outside the restored Church of God, but being here does not mean you are or that you even have God's Spirit. I think we are much, much higher in percentage converted and zealous. I do. I absolutely do. That's a different discussion as to why. All the reasons, what we've gone through and seen and learned and the condition of the world, I think people are much more zealous. But do not think that, like the group in Oklahoma that has named itself the Philadelphia Church of God, that membership here means you are Philadelphian. Surely, surely, the message from Worldwide tells you that isn't true. You are only Philadelphian if you are Philadelphian in condition on all points. You cannot do it anywhere else, being in the right place under God's government, doing His work, where all the truth is taught, where we understand what is the church, is the starting point. Of course, you have to be there. But it doesn't mean you're automatically Philadelphian. My wife and I are looking at things we could sell. We'll do anything. Absolutely, there's just no limits. I've already been looking into things. She is too. We're in this together. Now, three categories. Conclusion. There will be those who hear this message and request that they, you know, they're more faithful and generous and they're sacrificing their offerings, or that they give the 15% extra. Maybe some could give 25% to make up for those who can't. I don't know. 50%. I don't know. What are your limits? What do you have? Too much is given, much is required. There'll be those who hear all the message, all of this, and think the prophecy part was neat, and they will act on none of what I said. Not anything. Not once at all. That's a fact. This old soldier in God's way knows what he's talking about. Believe me. Even though I say there will be that category and talk about it, and I don't know how I could be plainer, they still won't hear it and they'll do nothing. There will be a second category who will hear it, be moved temporarily, much like the particularly powerful Holy Day offering messages last year at the feast that generated such a tremendous amount of income, and I knew there was a possibility this year we could sink. So I know that some will hear this, they'll act, and they'll keep their mind on it, and it will fade, and it'll just wind down. Because they can't sustain. They cannot endure to the goal, to the end. You ever wonder why it says, blessed is he that waits and comes to the 1,335 days? We know now exactly you're waiting for the exact same thing. In Luke 21:19, it says, in your patience, in your waiting, Matthew and Mark say enduring, you get to the end, which is the end of the work, the 1,335. You wait and you're blessed to get to that. That's the goal. But they can't sustain. They can't do it. Brethren, I implore each of us individually before our God to do all, I repeat, all that we can, according as we have been blessed. Pray about it. Not just the church as a whole. Yes, we've already said that. But pray about it individually. Your circumstances. Ask God to help you know what you can cut. Think about it. Pray about it. Meditate on it. Counsel with your husband or wife or even your minister if you need to. Or even us. You may call us, by the way. As before, 3 years ago, I explained, people want to call with amounts. Please do. Now, you don't have to. Some did, some didn't. Some just surprised us. But if you want counsel, you want to talk with us, that's fine. Some, by the way, recently have talked about giving us things to sell, and others have done that. And we will sell things for you if you can't sell them. We'll help you in that way. I mean, just say that. We're not a kind of a clearinghouse in that regard, but we're happy to. If you want to give and you want to be generous, but don't know how to sell it, then far be it from us to say, well, we can't help you do it, when both of us know that that would greatly benefit the work. Of course we will help you, and you just let us know in that regard. Now let me just say, figure out what you can give up. Figure out what you can sell. Figure out what you're sitting on that you can't take with you. And there'll be a third group who will hear this, and they'll give more than we can imagine. What I wish is everybody would hear it and act on it, and the work in the next calendar year because of how we are poised and ready and have been setting ourselves to go forward at this time, it will boggle your mind what could happen. It will boggle your mind. We are so ready, we're salivating in the office. Now, Mr. Armstrong said, back me up. I am asking you, back me up and back our ministers up and back our staff up. And let's go finish the work all the way to the goal.